Hey, good evening, Hayes. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you doing, Josh?
I'm good. I think we have quite a bit to talk about tonight. Oh, let's do
So
introductions
much.
first.
Oh,
So,
right.
sorry, who are you?
So, yeah, this is my first time doing this, so no one knows who this is. Hi, I'm Hayes Brown. I'm National Security Reporter with Think Progress. Been doing that for about 8 months now. So, yeah, that's what I do.
Cool, and I'm Joshua Faust. I'm a freelance writer now, and I guess relevant to this conversation, I used to work in the intelligence community for a couple of years. So, with that as the pivot, we have quite a bit to be talking about,
Yes, we do.
I think. So, this Edward Snowden fellow is quite an interesting character, at least from
He
everything I've been able to turn up.
really is. I kind of ran my mouth on Twitter without watching the video first, which got me into a little trouble today. But actually watching the video, he's clearly comes across as an intelligent, articulate person who didn't really just do this as a whim. He comes across as a very sympathetic figure and someone who, so I give kudos to Guardian for thinking up the idea of putting together this video and putting it out there because A, it's going to help push the discussion forward more and keep them more in the news, and B, because adding a human element to it is just really what the story was lacking and what's going to make it not die down as quickly as at least I was predicting.
Yeah, I think as kind of a PR stratagem, it's very smart of them to lay it out this way. And I'm, in a way, really impressed with the guy's balls for being able to come public like this. There are going to be a lot of people in DC gunning for him. And I don't just mean like journalist types trying to unravel who he is. I mean like the government is going to be responding in some way. And whatever else going on, like I gotta say, it takes serious balls to just come out and kind of defiantly say, yeah, I did it.
True. One thing though, I have to point out in the video, he takes a little bit of a what I see as paranoid view of what the government is going to do in response. I mean, DOJ, we know that NSA opened up their whistleblower investigation case thing the other night, but the way he described it, he sounded like they're going to get the triad on him, which I don't really see as being something that is going to be done. I mean, let's put it this way: if he knew in coming forward that if he turns up dead, then people are going to talk, and people are going to have suspicions, which is smart of him.
And there are a couple other things about it that I mean, I've been a part of this discussion on Twitter all night. This is Sunday night that we're recording this. Even apart from kind of the details of his biography, his decision to flee to Hong Kong,
Yeah,
as
that was
if
a
Hong
weird
Kong
one.
is this bastion of free speech and political dissidence, struck me as a really bizarre choice.
Yes, I mean,
And
did he not see the first Rush Hour movie? Does he not remember that it was handed back over to China?
it was the second Rush Hour, I think, when they went back to Hong Kong,
No, the
right?
first one. It was the first one where the plot was centered around the handover from.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right?
Well, I mean, there's that. Like, Hong Kong does operate under a different set of principles from mainland China, but
Right.
I mean, freedom of speech there is prescribed, and the capacity of people there to protest the government is constantly disputed by Beijing. So, the other side of this, and this gets back, I think, at DC people kind of starting to go after him, is that by fleeing essentially to China, I mean, people from Hong Kong have Chinese passports.
Right.
Fleeing to China and then announcing his decision to like expose the NSA or whatever is immediately going to open him up to charges of either defection or in some way of aiding the Chinese. No matter what he's saying to the Guardian, no matter what he's saying to the press, there's going to be this assumption that he went to Hong Kong with a cache of documents and basically handed them over. And kind of in the process of that, I mean, talking about how he was trying to defend himself against eavesdropping by like stuffing a towel underneath his door. I mean, it almost sounded like a Mr. Magoo understanding of what espionage was. I mean, like, if he works for the NSA, he knows that they can bounce a laser off his hotel mirror and hear what he's saying inside his room. Like, that's been public knowledge for a really long time. So, I mean, there's a little bit of kind of like showmanship almost in this that I found just really interesting, and I'm still really not sure what to make of it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, also, I mean, one of the things that people are going to parse for a really long time is trying to figure out exactly how much of his claim about what he personally could do as a system admin for the NSA as a contractor with Booz Hamilton, can do. I mean, some of it is a little out there in terms of him being able to personally access the programs and run them in such a way that he could act as basically a de facto NSA agent or an analyst. Yeah. That's concerning. And also, I'm not sure how accurate it is, and I don't know how we would figure that out at this point to determine.
You know, one of the challenges, and this has always been one of the challenges with talking about the damage that the other big leak has done, the WikiLeaks has done,
mm-hmm.
is that by design, all of this stuff is so heavily classified. I mean, you know, Booz Allen, they've only acknowledged that he worked for them. They haven't confirmed anything else about his story, about whether
right.
he had the job title he said he had, whether he even made the rather eye-popping amount of money he had. I mean, this is a guy who dropped out of high school, somehow joined the Army without having a GED, which struck me as kind of weird. And then in the space of, like, 3 or 4 years, went from being a security guard doing facility guarding, like, literally standing outside a door and manning a desk at a building, to being this, like, highfalutin NSA operative. I mean, there's a lot of stuff about that just, you know, you hear it, and your first instinct is, wait, really? Does that really happen?
As far as recruiting goes, I saw Tim Matthews on Twitter pointed out that, given the time frame, it wouldn't be too weird for some shady recruiting officer to say, well, you have your GED now, son, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and just pass him through. But, there are parts of his story that are definitely concerning, but here's the thing. The way that this has been put forward, any attempt to question that, you're going to have people who say, oh, you're just shilling for the government and trying to discredit this brave whistleblower, which doesn't really do the conversation much good, nor I think actually does the fact that if we do make him the conversation, then we run the risk of just completely forgetting about the rest of the fact. Like, as the Bradley Manning trial moves forward, we've basically stopped discussing whether WikiLeaks, that phase especially, was right or wrong. One of the things that I always have trouble telling people is that I was completely for WikiLeaks up until a certain point. Like, when they released the Iraq documents that showed Blackwater taking down a helicopter, taking down civilians, I was like, yeah, good for you guys. That is something that we need to know about how this war is being fought. Afghanistan, that treasure trove of documents. Like, okay, yeah, we're fighting a war. We need to know about this. When they released all the diplomatic information is when I stopped and said, no, you guys are no longer doing this for, like, the public good. You guys are just basically doing this because you can. And that's when it becomes a problem.
You mean in a way when they shifted from whistleblowing to just exposing?
Yeah, that's definitely the case.
And that's a distinction, I think, that in a lot of this gets completely obscured. I think there's this tendency that, and, you know, in a way I can understand the reasoning that someone like Glenn Greenwald applies to this, because he assumes that government is inherently evil, it's inherently out to hurt people.
Sorry, maybe not that they're inherently evil, but that they are inherently designed to not tell you things that they know.
To not tell you things, yeah. And you know, like, if the government lies, if they hide things, if you think that they're hiding bad things, then therefore anyone who exposes that is a brave whistleblower and deserves praise. Like, you know, Greenwald and I disagree on a lot of things, but, you know, I think his principles at least are consistent in that sense.
Right.
The problem is that if you don't share the assumption that government is kind of, like, inherently malicious in a lot of these things, which is not an assumption that I have, it's more difficult to kind of accept carte blanche than that just exposing this stuff makes one a whistleblower. And I think that's where the public good arguments become both more important, but also much more difficult.
Right.
Like what you're describing with the leak of the State Department cables. I mean, ultimately, the effect that had was kind of attacking the system of international diplomacy,
right.
which, yes, has exposed some really interesting things, but that has consequences. That has some really serious consequences that we're still dealing with in a lot of ways. I mean, to me, one of the most kind of pernicious ones was when Ambassador Gene Kretz had to be recalled from Tripoli because of the WikiLeaks revelations right before the Arab Spring happened and right before we needed an ambassador in Tripoli dealing with Gaddafi and dealing with the decision to intervene in the civil war there. I mean, that essentially left a vacuum at the top of the diplomatic post right when it would have been needed the most. And we don't know what the ultimate effects were of that, in part because people are loath to talk about it inside the State Department, but that had really serious consequences. With this stuff, you know, the bit about exposing Verizon or exposing this prison program. I mean, whatever. I think we can talk about whether or not that's prurient or really interesting. But then exposing the government's plans in cyber conflict, essentially their planning documents, that is something that I don't understand how it can be reasonably portrayed as whistleblowing. Because ultimately, that's a kind of contingency planning government should do. And essentially, he's denying the U.S. an advantage in that conflict and giving everyone else who wants to defeat the U.S. an advantage. And that's not aiding the enemy, which is a stupid phrase that gets entered into this, but it's really damaging, and people don't really grapple with that damage.
I completely agree. On the offensive cyber operations thing, that just really, it was a come on, guys. Of course we are. Of course we are. And of course it's going to be secret because no one wants to be the first one to come out and give basically their version of a first strike doctrine on cyber offense. Yeah. No one wants to be that guy, especially not the U.S. And from the way it was phrased in the article, it sounds like they're taking every precaution to make this in cahoots with the U.S. and international law, which is something that I think is really important, and I'm glad that they're doing it. I just didn't need to know yet. And what really ground my gears, as you saw on Twitter last night, was when they put out this boundless informant information, which parts of it I agree with. That should be known. We should know that Clapper might not have been telling the full truth. DNI James Clapper might not have been telling the full truth about how much data from the U.S. Right. gets sucked up.
In open testimony. And in that same testimony, though, didn't he say there's classified addendums to this?
Right. And so being able to parse that sort of thing out, that I think has at least some value. Telling Iran that they are the number one target of our signal intelligence, that has no real value that I can discern. Saying that, putting up a map showing several of our allies being tapped, that's just embarrassing. That's not something that they or we needed to really know. They could have framed the article in such a way to really leave those parts out, and that they didn't says I feel a lot about what their goal is in putting out this information. I think that Snowden said that he went through the documents, he tried to discern what was important, what could be harmful, and more props to him for doing that. Not everyone would even take the time to do that and just hand over everything. But
for example, Bradley Manning didn't.
Yes, that is very true. But in doing so, he still left things in there that if you aren't thinking from the point of view of how can anyone use this, then I'm not sure that the full job was done.
No. And part of the reason why is the guy's job to begin with. He was a systems administrator, a sysadmin.
Right, he was an analyst.
Build networks, and they maintain networks. Like, when your email breaks, you contact a sysadmin.
Right.
They are not hired for their operational judgment. They're not hired for their understanding of operations, for their understanding of, like, policy security guidelines. I mean, they're hired literally to build and run networks. Mm-hmm. In some cases, they're hired to run, like, software programs or complicated enterprise systems. But ultimately, like, he's a techie. He's the IT guy that you call to either build something or fix something when it's broken. He's not the guy who makes decisions. He wasn't an analyst. I mean, and to kind of, like, aggregate to himself all of this authority to expose things and decide on his own as a 29-year-old guy who was on the job for a couple of months that this stuff needed to be exposed. I mean, to me, that's a remarkable leap of logic to make and an extraordinary decision to make with, extraordinary consequences. He seems aware of the fact that he's ruined his life probably forever, and he's probably also ruined his family and his girlfriend's lives too. And I don't think he realizes it still reaches further than that, the stuff that he was exposing.
Yeah, so, I mean, I mean, this isn't to judge the fact that he might have had access to the various things that he said he did, but I'm not sure that I agree. I don't think he knew fully just what he was pulling the covers back on in terms of how this affects everything. And I'm honestly not sure how much this will affect the overarching debate that he was hoping to spur forward. I mean, on the one hand, it's kind of a good thing that this did happen outside of a major election year. I mean, if this happened next year, then it would completely become quickly very partisan, very rancorous, just finger-pointing, he said, she said. And right now, there's a slim window, I feel like, to maybe actually have an actual debate on what we're doing with this. President Obama, in his NDU speech, talked about revising and eventually repealing the authorization for the use of military force in 2001. And that's going to be a huge fight. The Patriot Act, though, that's going to be even bigger because, like Obama said when he took questions the other day, he came into office very skeptical by his telling, and once his people got through looking at everything that we can't see, they realized this actually is kind of a good thing. Also, one thing that I saw this morning and no one really picked up on it, Senator Mark Udall, one of the biggest advocates for personal privacy in terms of the surveillance state, quote-unquote, came out and said the PRISM program, which is the one that most of us felt more troubled by, the program that's taking all this data from various internet companies, that's been, quote, extremely effective in combating terrorism. That's what he said, and no one really raised their eyebrows at the fact that he was defending this program that no one seemed to like when it was revealed.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's also worthwhile, and I'm sure Senator Udall would do this too, to draw a line between a program being effective and a program being moral. I mean, you could make the argument, and people like Mark Thiessen make it all the time, that things like Extraordinary Rendition was a really effective instrument in the war on terrorism. That doesn't mean it was moral, and that doesn't mean that we should be doing it. Like, the ends really don't justify the means in that case. But, you know, the PRISM story, though, was really interesting. The Guardian was, astonishingly to me at least, a bit more reserved in how it described it. The Washington Post published their own story on PRISM, and I think it's interesting to think about how this guy, Edward Snowden, sent these documents to both newspapers.
I have a theory about this.
Story. Okay, yeah, go for it.
So I think the link is actually Laura P. What's her last name? Poynher? Is that correct? The one who had the byline with Barton Gettleman on the Washington Post story, she was also in the room with Greenwald and the other interview from Guardian. She was the filmmaker. So I think she's the real connection between Washington Post and Guardian. Okay. I think she's the one who possibly was the one reached out to. This is just all speculation at this point, but
that they've been working on that story for months. So, I mean, I don't know. It could be that Snowden approached them first, and when they didn't publish soon enough, he went to The Guardian. That's another possibility.
Right.
But what I find more interesting than any of this, I mean, this is what I was going to say beforehand, is that the first version the Post put out with, that the NSA had this, like, collaborative, direct relationship with these companies, turned out to be entirely wrong.
Right.
And that when actual tech journalists looked at that and they went, wait, what? And looked into this, they then said, oh, none of this actually adds up. There's much more to the story than we thought.
Right.
And the Post itself, with very, very little fanfare, really walked back and altered its original reporting to say something, I think, dramatically different from the first version they put out. There's kind of a lesson in this. Like, whenever events are breaking, the Boston Marathon was a great example of this. Mm-hmm. The first version of events that we get is probably going to be wrong. And I think we're going to find with a lot of this stuff that it's probably going to be wrong. Like, this PRISM thing, Clapper, over the weekend, said that PRISM wasn't really a program. It was an internal government computer system. And if you Google the PRISM acronym on, you know, government contracts and stuff, you can find other tools there also called PRISM.
Right.
So, I mean, in a way, and there are social consequences online to saying we should kind of accept a little bit what the government is saying in this case, but I think they're correct when they say that we don't have all of the context for this stuff. We definitely don't have all the context to be making judgments about it. And that's something that I find almost as remarkable as the fact that these leaks were happening, is that they're happening at the same time in such a limited and possibly, like, fatally limited way.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I want to give props really quickly. A shout out to my coworker, Andrea Peterson. She's our tech reporter at Think Progress. And before anyone else, she was, I feel like, one of the first people to make the connection about the fact that they probably didn't have direct access to these companies' servers. Yep. So mad props to her. And just complete sidebar, I really hope that people do take to heart this idea that first story is usually probably wrong idea. Next time something, a Benghazi happens, for example, and realize that sometimes just information changes and doesn't mean you were lying about it. It just means that you weren't 100% accurate. And so you go back and you fix it. And so on this whole NSA story, I agree that we're seeing a very small portion of things. And that's at the same time worrying in that we don't know how deep this rabbit hole goes. And concerning in that we also have these people reporting on things where they can't see the whole thing. It's like if you were reporting on a tree and you find a couple of leaves and you try and make a whole story about it without getting to the trunk, to the roots, to all this.
There's a famous metaphor about that, about blind men trying to describe an elephant.
Right.
Is that if you have three blind guys touching an elephant to try to describe what it's like, they're all going to come up with very, very different ideas of what an elephant really is.
Right.
And in a way, like that might even be apropos, because this is kind of an elephant. Like, it's huge and kind of cool, but also dangerous, and you don't really want to get too close to it at the same time.
You don't want to provoke it unless you get run over.
As much as we need to.
It's also highly endangered and poached for its ivory.
Yes, it is. There's one last thing, though, that I do want to bring up about this, and this is how secret all of this stuff actually was to begin with.
Right.
Because, you know, I can remember back in 2006, USA Today publishing a story about how the NSA was reading all of our emails.
Mm-hmm.
That they'd, like, cracked open Gmail, they'd cracked open Yahoo, cracked open Hotmail, and there was basically no privacy left. And people, for the most part, reacted to that with a yawn. In 2005, when James Ryson reported that the NSA was tapping our phone calls without a warrant, people not only reacted with a yawn, but then Congress gave everyone legal immunity from any kind of legal fallout that might have happened. And then later in 2008, and this is actually a bit of a beef that I have with Senators Udall and Wyden, when the FISA Amendments Act was – or sorry, in 2012, when the FISA Amendments Act was being renewed, you know, they raised concerns about things, but they never held the – after their amendments to force more secrecy about legal reasoning got voted down, important note there, like the Senate actually voted against them.
Right.
But then, you know, they never tried to put a hold on the legislation. They never pulled a Rand Paul and, like, filibustered everything that was happening.
And they never pulled the nuclear option, which would have been amazing.
And they never pulled the nuclear option. And so I still have a lot of lingering questions here when people try to say, oh, I was on top of this all along and this was a huge concern, and oh, why didn't I care about it so much? Because honestly, people didn't make that huge of a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot that I'm still trying to wrap my head around about how much culpability we have for this, how much culpability the government does. Because when people defend this program as saying, you know, the executive was carrying this out under congressional oversight and with the full disclosure and review of the courts, I mean, they're technically accurate. That could mean that our system doesn't work, which is its own rather interesting and terrifying conversation to have. But to imply somehow that, like, democracy was being subverted, right now strikes me as a really just foolish thing to say, because this is the result of our system functioning.
Right.
We don't like the results of the system functioning, and that's fine. That's worth discussing. But our system is actually functioning, including having all three branches of oversight of all three branches of government exercising oversight. And I still don't know how to wrap my head around all of that.
I agree. I mean, I was talking to my girlfriend earlier about this today and trying to theorize about just why it's becoming such a big issue now as opposed to before. One of the theories I came up with was that under the Bush administration, it was very easy to be jaded and say, of course they were doing these things, and just forget about it. All these, like the 2006 issue, the 2005 story on wiretaps and legal immunities, and also, let's not forget that as late as 2006, we were still very much, as a nation, in the we're at war mentality. It wasn't until 2007, I feel like, that we really started to break with that en masse and started to move away from that sort of idea that we have to be at war forever against these vague enemies that we have out there. So part of the reaction right now is it's a little bit of guilt that people are feeling that they didn't take it up sooner, especially liberals with Obama, in my personal opinion, that they didn't challenge him more on – why did we challenge him more on the Patriot Act renewal? Why didn't we push back more? Why did we take his word for it? And so that's why some of this, I think, is coming out more, because with Bush, you're sort of like, oh, he sucks. Of course he's doing this. But with Obama, it's like, we believed in you, man. We thought that something big would change, and to have those expectations – dashed, I suppose, it could be sparking some of the backlash that we're seeing here. Not to discredit the fact that some of these revelations are pretty concerning. I mean, on the whole Verizon and metadata issue, I mean, I'm more than a little concerned about how these things are carried out. I agree that they are carried out under the law. I know that you and I both agree, though, that there are too many things in this country that are classified that don't need to be. And,
right.
And that it's going to take forever to try to declassify them because, well, A, it takes a long time in general, and B, thanks to Quester, they actually slowed down the process of declassification thanks to the Quester. Lay people off.
And also, here's an important wrinkle to this. The flood of FOIA requests in mm-hmm. response to overclassification has also led... Well, and it's also, I think, in some cases, there are frivolous FOIA requests, too. But
oh, like,
just the recent flood of FOIA requests has clogged up the system so much that I don't think they have the means to really dig themselves out. And this gets wrapped up in another kind of paradox about this, which is that leaks are not how you solve a system that overclassifies information.
Right.
It's actually how you kind of incur a defensive crouch and make classification worse and worse. And I know that in the wake of WikiLeaks, that the government responded by locking up access to things, mm-hmm. putting things on higher-level networks with higher-level caveats behind them and more restrictive handling instructions. And
right.
it made everything much harder to ever kind of disentangle from itself. So in a major way, these sorts of actions are kind of like ironically self-defeating. And that's something, too, that a lot of the people proclaiming themselves transparency advocates at all of this, I don't think have ever really gotten. It's... Honestly, I see a parallel with people who want to close Guantanamo of instead of working through the really difficult bureaucratic and political issues that need to be worked through to get that done,
mm-hmm.
they'd rather just take unilateral action, kind of like demanding President Obama just override Congress somehow and and close the prison. And
I mean,
no,
to be fair, he could totally close Guantanamo.
He's
just barred from law from, you know, bringing them to the United States, putting them anywhere else.
Right.
He just...
Right.
So I agree with you there.
But you know what I mean, though? Like, it's more complicated than just Obama saying, no, it must be closed. Like, he doesn't have a magic wand he can wave and just make things happen. And it's the same thing, actually, with secrecy and with overclassification. You can't just snap your fingers and tell the government, well, just declassify things less, or just classify them less highly, or declassify them more. I mean, that's kind of a petulant response to something that is way more complicated than just up or down, yes or no, secret or not secret.
Agreed.
And that complexity gets completely lost when these kinds of leaks happen and everyone starts screaming about all the secret shit that's going on, secret stuff that's going on. Sorry.
So the real question then is how do we actually try and wind this back? I mean, if leaks aren't the real solution to it, how do we actually get people to realize that, A, things are going on that they have no idea about thanks to overclassification, and B, how do we convince the people who do the classifying that it's not in their best interest to keep this going indefinitely, to keep ratcheting up the level of secrecy on basically everything? I mean, I can see the idea behind there that, oh, if we just put things out into the open, then people will realize things are happening and they'll demand even more action. I can see that logic making sense. So if that's not true, then what can we do to really try and roll this back aside from just massive overturn in Congress to try and get them to pass different laws?
Yeah, I mean, I actually tried to map out some of these ideas in an op-ed on Friday about what do these actually reveal about the way that our political culture functions. And the best that I could come out with is that what these reveal is we actually have an almost alarming intolerance of risk. So despite all of the cliches, and I think it's technically a false understanding of what Benjamin Franklin was saying about trading secrecy and liberty, and people who do that don't deserve either.
Right.
He was actually talking about like the right of the right of Pennsylvania to rebel against the British or something. Like it wasn't the same context that we kind of have associated it with since. But
mm-hmm.
you know, what Americans have shown the last 12 years is that they're perfectly happy to remove privacy in exchange for security. We do it at the airport every time we fly. We do
yep.
it every single time we consent to background checks, every time we consent to like the police checking our ID on the street. I mean, we've consented to this by and large. And as much as kind of, I mean, I hesitate to just say like urban elites complain about that, although that seems to be where you hear like the loudest arguments about it. Ultimately, like, Americans have gotten the system that they deserve. Like, we voted for it. We vote for the people who create and expand and support it. And when it makes itself more intrusive, we don't really react all that much. So kind of at a basic level, I mean, to even start rolling this back, I think it needs to start there of really looking at what we consider to be tolerable levels of risk and tolerable levels of security. And that, again, that's not an easy question to say, because if you come out into the public and say, I think we need to allow more Boston bombings to happen because yeah. I deserve privacy, no one can run for office on that platform.
No, you really
can't.
They'll
just not get voted for.
Well,
so,
Ron Paul could run for office on that, but God rest him, he's not running anymore.
I mean, yeah, that's the point, though. He's not running anymore. And interestingly, during the primaries, that message was a loser. No one liked it. So, you know, ultimately, as we can talk about all of these other things, really get into, like, the nitty-gritty kind of policy level or legal stuff about exactly what specific profile of information deserves to be secret versus what can be realistically declassified without there being too much challenge. But I think ultimately what we have to grapple with is the fact that Americans want a very strong security state, and they don't mind having their privacy infringed in the process. And I have no idea how you go about actually changing that.
I'm not sure either. I mean, I think a lot of it, we'll see how people react to this story 3 weeks from now, whether they're still paying attention to it and trying to actually push change, or whether we're immersed in scandal number 27 of the week and trying to figure out how the Obama administration is going to survive this one. That it all depends on how much I feel like people continue paying attention to it.
Yeah,
and part of that's on the shoulders of the media to make sure that we keep pushing the story. I'm pretty sure Think Progress isn't going to give up on it anytime soon. But we can't shape public opinion as much as people seem to think. The media, we can't dictate to people exactly what they should believe on every issue and what they should and should not care about.
Yeah.
Man, this is the most depressing Sunday night.
I agree with that to a degree. Like, last year, I shouldn't say last year, last week, wow, it's Sunday night. Last week, you know, I said pretty publicly that I'm pessimistic that ultimately this is going to change. And it comes back to what I said like 2 minutes ago. Like, ultimately, this is what people asked for. Mm-hmm. And it's what they've gotten. Frankly, Barack Obama's counterterrorism policies poll really well. That's arguably the one part of his administration that's really popular in a vast majority of the population. So, I mean, when most of the country wants something to happen, I'm a little flummoxed about how you really shift that opinion, at least in anything approaching the short term. In the long run, though, and this is where I kind of disagree with you a bit, like, I don't think it'll really determine what things are like 3 weeks from now, but rather if in 6 months we're still having, at least in media somehow or at a more grassroots level, having that conversation about security versus privacy and whether or not the government really should have the right to look into the stuff that it can look into. Mm-hmm. If that's happening 6 months from now, then I could maybe be more optimistic that we might actually be able to shift the needle a little bit on this. But without sustained political, I mean, activism is the only way I can think of putting it, but without sustained political activity, I don't see how you get something that's built up piece by piece over 13 years to just roll back in a couple of weeks. I don't think that's a realistic expectation.
No, I didn't mean so much as, like, action will be taken in the next 3 weeks. I meant whether or not people still seem to be talking about it 3 weeks from now. I mean, to get to 6 months, you have to get past the first 3 weeks. So I think that I'm actually attending the Netroots conference in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to be curious to see whether or not people are still – the level of outrage that this granted bastion of liberal elitism really has once we get there, because it's a couple of weeks from now. And I just want to know whether people are going to start organizing around this, whether more plans are pushed forward there to really combat this, because I clearly, as I write for Think Progress, I identify mostly as liberals, though part of the liberal ideas on foreign policy don't really exist.
Right.
So I'm kind of in a no man's land a lot of the time. But it's true. I mean, we really bad at this game. I mean, for all the talk about how Democrats are winning the war against Republicans in terms of people see them as better on national security. that's all well and good, but when it comes to like pure ideology, we don't really do foreign policy very well.
Well, and I'd even say like among the 1% of the country that registers any real interest in foreign policy
mm-hmm.
to begin with.
Yeah.
Like, that's the other side of it, is that, I mean, I thought that was one of the more interesting opinion polls during the election last year, is how few people ever cared about foreign policy.
Yeah.
You know, they cared more about their employment and their bank accounts and whether mm-hmm. they could afford school, things that were a little more like day-to-day.
Which is all well and good, which is great for them. I mean,
yeah.
If we didn't live here, it's probably entirely likely we'd be more concerned about those issues, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on that note, we get to end on a thumbs up.
Hooray.
Times, right? Oh, man. Okay.
This has been depressing. Fun times.
It's been utterly depressing. I mean... You know, I usually end these kinds of conversations with people when we just want to, like, bat around ideas and talk about things. And you reach a point where you're just like, what do you do about this? And then someone always invariably goes, well, this is why we drink.
Yeah. Yeah. Good thing we chose to do this on a Sunday night when we can't just go out and just... good times. Good times, I tells you.
I think this is a good time to end our conversation.
Probably.